This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and welcome to the morning run on BFM 89.9, the business station. 6 o'clock this Tuesday morning. It's the 28th of February. I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Tan Chung Han here with me in the studio. Good morning, Han.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning,
everyone.
Yes. So today on The Breakfast Grill, Han, you're going to be speaking to Datuk Mazlin Muhammad Junid, CEO of Enra Group. So I haven't really heard about them. What do they do?
Well, they are actually a property investment company, or at least they started off that way all the way back in 1992. They've had different names. They began as Orlando Holdings. Then they changed the name to Formis, then Perduren. I think many people might still know of them as Perduren, okay. Before being called Enra in 2015. So essentially, they started as a property investment company, but over the last couple of years, they're starting to make forays into the oil and gas space.
Oh.
So from property to oil and gas, diversifying into oil and gas.
Well, that's a tough space to be in at this point in time. Actually, both property and oil and gas are facing their own unique set of challenges, right?
Yeah, that's what you would think. But then when you look at their most recent earnings for the final 3 months of 2016, their net income rose by 115% on year.
Thanks to oil and gas?
Basically revenue from both property and oil and gas. But then, you know, to be fair, you know, they are basically coming from a low base effect. You know? So the net income only came in at about 10.9 million ringgit, or as maybe Chuang would call it, lunch money. I don't know. I'm totally going to pick on him because he's not here for now. Yeah, he'll be here tomorrow. Yeah.
Okay, well, that sounds interesting. I'm curious to know more. Datuk Mazlin Muhammad Junid, CEO of Enra Group, will be on The Breakfast Grill today. So make sure you catch that interview. That's at 8 o'clock. And after the grill on current affairs, we explore the human rights abuse in Iranian federal prisons. Now, 2 months ago, Syed Sherzad sewed his lips together, and that started a hunger strike in Iranian prisons. He's a political activist, and he wanted to protest the unreported deaths of prisoners in Iranian prisons as a result of the abuse at the hands of prison officials. Now, this was really quite a horrifying story. First, it started as a hunger strike. I think many other prisoners participated as well. But it went on for so many days, and you know, it got so much international attention. But I wonder whether it was an effective means of protest in bringing about change, right?
Well, you know, whether it's effective or not, that's up for debate. But, you know, at least from where I stand, oh my word, you know, the kind of willpower to actually go on this prolonged hunger strike, I mean, that's just mind-blowing to me. You know, I certainly tip my hat off, you know, when it comes to their motivation. I mean, they got to have such an elevated belief in that cause to actually deny yourself, you know, some basic needs, really.
Yeah, I mean, of course, the hunger strike is a pressure tactic that's mostly associated with Mahatma Gandhi, non-violence pressure tactic. But whether it's drawn so much international media attention, I'm curious to know whether this has brought about change in Iranian prisons. In fact, what we did was spoke to Dr. James Dorsey, a senior fellow at the Rajaratnam School of International Studies in Singapore. And here's a clip of him explaining that the recent international media report on hunger strikes in Iran is only, in fact, just a fragment of the larger human rights violations in federal prisons there.
The prison that I visited many years ago is notorious, but so are other prisons. And it's not just on hunger strikers, but certainly political prisoners as such. So that's a longstanding allegation. Iran has long not let a UN rapporteur into Iran and into the prisons themselves. But abuse of hunger strikers is far larger and more general picture of abuse.
That was Dr. James Dorsey from the S. Rajaratnam School in Singapore. You know, Han, it's sometimes really hard to care about all the human rights violations happening around the world, especially one that feels so far away. But, you know, as the media, it's our job to shine a light on these issues. Even though it feels far away, it's, you know, it's so relatable. We've had so many deaths in custody here in Malaysia. And, you know, commentators are saying, are the police serious about combating this issue?
Yeah, no, and then, I mean, On one hand, you look at here in our own backyard, if you recall the logging controversy, you know, over there in the eastern part of the peninsula,
right.
You know, and there were, you know, claims that the Orang Asli folk over there, you know, their rights were being infringed on, right? You know, but yet when that story was, you know, seemingly dominating like social media, it gained, you know, relatively lesser traction, you know, mm-hmm. in the mainstream media. And of course, you know, then you've got the urban folk, you know, who then are forced to ask themselves, you know, why do we even care, right? You know, so you've got that sense of, not to say forget what's happening in Iran and India, but, you know, if you can't even bring yourself to care about what's going on here at home,
right.
You know, what more, you know, is the human rights abuses in, you know, Iran and India, you know, relevance to you, right?
Well, we spoke...
Again, not that I'm justifying it.
But we spoke a couple of weeks ago about how Pope Francis had said, you know, the key to a good and healthy and peaceful life is if you can't care about everything, right? I can't remember his exact words. I must be paraphrasing here. But he said, you know, to the right amount of not to care. If there's a certain amount that you just, you cannot care about everything, or it will drive you completely bonkers.
No, yeah.
So perhaps, you know, we can still allocate some time and awareness to issues that are happening around the world, but I think it's really difficult to care about everything.
Well,
right?
Certainly, yeah. You know, I agree, because at the same time, you know, given the permeation of social media, right, it brings everything to your doorstep, or literally right in front of your eyeballs. You know, do you really have the emotional and mental capacity to care for every single issue? I mean, there are just, you know, dozens, hundreds, you know, out there, right? You know, how do you even allocate not just resources, you know, we won't even go there yet, just time and like the kind of emotion, right, to be invested in these kind of causes.
I do agree, but I do think that maybe, you know, it's still important to just be aware, right? So even if you cannot, you know, be the political activist for the human rights abuses that are happening in federal prisons in Iran, at least know about it. At least know that it's happening, so that you can be informed, that you can be a global citizen too. And if you do want to know more, Current Affairs is the exact show for you at 8:30 discuss this.
I'll be looking forward to it. And then perhaps also, you know, instead of maybe caring about so many things, instead of going for breadth, go for depth. You know, so pick one cause, you know, that you really care for, and then go for it. Like for me, it's education. You know, so pick that one cause, get involved, and then go from there.
Fantastic. Well, let's move on to later on the show at 9:30 on the Morning Run. We have the BBC World Service. This week's episode, we take a look at London's future as Europe's premier financial centre and what happens to it after Brexit. As you know, the UK is now just weeks away from triggering Article 50. That's the two-year process under which the country will leave the European Union. And the BBC today will be speaking to a whole host of commentators, some of whom argue that London will be able to retain its financial crown. And they say that don't penalise the UK financial sector for Brexit. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it's idealistic to think that London will not be impacted after the Brexit, that London will not see its financial status as a hub in Europe shaken a little bit, you know?
Yeah, no, in recent weeks and months, you know, there have already been so many financial centres that have set out plans to move to, you know, the likes of Frankfurt, you know, basically the mainland Europe, basically away from London in light of Brexit. In fact, there was a recent interview on Bloomberg where they asked the German central banker, you know, basically talk up the merits of Frankfurt in attracting these banks, you know. So you've got that discussion going already, you know, already hitting central bankers, you know, what more down on the streets of London there?
Well, you know, I mean, it's going to be really hard to be the financial centre of Europe if you don't have the free flow of, you know, people, immigration, if the UK does decide to put curbs on immigration. That is definitely going to impact London as a financial centre.
Do you remember at the height of the Brexit, or very shortly after the Brexit referendum, there were calls for London to be its own, like, city-state or so? Do you remember those calls?
Secede into...
Maybe they should revisit that. Yeah.
Well, you know...
Issue a London passport.
Yesterday, in the UK, there were reports that the Scottish government could be set to call for a second independence referendum as Article 50 is triggered, because the UK Times reported that there is serious concern that Nicola Sturgeon will use the start of the Brexit process to demand another vote on the future of the UK.
You know, and then you see what's happening in Scotland and also the rise of the nationalistic sentiment in France, you know, and all the headlines being dominated by Marie Le Pen, you know. So, hey, Europe, lots of fun.
Interesting times ahead for sure, I have to say. I mean, that is definitely one thing we're going to keep an eye on. But also the BBC World Service will be featuring Lucy Calloway of the Financial Times. I love her. I love her writing. And to hear her speak every week is really quite interesting. This week, her op-ed on radio is about the art of getting people to do what you want them to do. She reckons there's an art to it. There's, you know, there's an art to getting to being persuasive.
Now, isn't that the definition of power? Like, power is the ability to get people to do what you want them to do, right? So if I have the power to say, you know, increase your taxes, it's like, you're going to do what I want you to do.
Well, she reckons that, you know, there are some people who manipulate, some people who threaten, who use fear. But she reckons the best way to get people to do what you want them to do is to be polite, to say please and thank you, and to flatter unrelentingly. So flattery will get you everywhere.
Yeah, but try that on a 2-year-old who's throwing a temper tantrum. No, it's like, please, honey.
That's bribery.
Get off the floor.
That's bribery. I'll give you I'll give you
chocolate
ice cream.
Candy. Yeah, it's like, I don't know if that works.
That's true. I do. I'm really interested to see whether this works. I mean, there's a part of me that wonders, don't people see right through it? I mean, if someone wants me to do something, I know they want me to do something. And, you know, to be all like, oh, but you're so pretty today. You're so good at it. You should do it.
Wow.
I would feel completely manipulated and, you know, and resentful.
Wow, this is starting to become a whole different show right now.
But you know, it's like a mind game, don't you think? It's like slightly a mind game.
No,
manipulating.
You know, I agree, but I think a big component to be considered here is the other person's personality or credibility. You know, how you view the person. For example, if let's say, I don't know, Melissa, I'm going to take a wild guess here. Let's say Bruno Mars. There we go. Bruno Mars comes up and pays you compliments. Oh yeah, great. You know, like you just lap it all up, you know, and you'll probably do whatever.
If he serenades me, that would be
right.
A bonus.
Exactly. Yeah. No, but if let's say, I don't know, Chuang.
Okay. Oh, he's the butt of my jokes today.
I know, that's the same thing. You're like, what do you want? Right? You'll be suspicious, you know. So I think a lot of it is the credibility or how you perceive the person's intentions. Yeah.
Well, I also believe saying please and thank you can go a really long way. I mean, if you just say, can you do this for me? Versus, you know, could you please do that? I know I don't mean to trouble you. And I think the manner in which it's delivered also goes a long way. And I'm sure that's a couple of the top tips Lucy Calloway will give on the art of getting people to do what you want them to do.
Do you think that's something that's rather lacking in the Malaysian context?
The please and thank yous?
Please and thank yous and maybe the art of persuasion.
For sure. I actually, when you talk about please and thank yous, I never understand why I'm the one saying thank you to the cashier at the grocery store. I'm the one saying thank you so much, and I'm like, wait a minute, isn't she supposed to be thanking me?
Well, I guess, you know,
I just gave her business.
Yeah. Well, she's providing you a service, I guess, and you know, that's one way of looking at it. Yeah.
True. So. There you go. All right. Well, find out more on the BBC World Service today at 9:30. Lucy Calloway, as well as the topic of London's future as the premier financial centre. And very quickly before we head into the break, you may have heard by now that you know what happened with the Oscars yesterday. That is all anyone is talking about.
Oh, man.
The biggest shock in the Oscar history, Moonlight having been declared best picture only after the producers of La La Land had accepted their statues for that prize. It was a cringeworthy moment.
It was. Did you see the video?
I did see the video. I actually was rather confused initially, just watching the video. I was confused at how that happened. But after, you know, further reportage on this, it was then explained that there were two people with two sets of envelopes, and they had handed the wrong envelope to Warren Beatty, and that's why they made that mistake.
And this is where you give a shout out to Steve Harvey, though. Oh my word, you know. I'm done. You know, someone else has, you know, no someone one, else is king of the hill right now.
No one remembers what Steve Harvey did anymore for mistakenly announcing the wrong winner
Miss Universe.
For Miss
Universe. Yeah, a couple of years ago. Right. You know, although he did atone for his mistakes in the most recent Miss Universe. So
can I say though? I think what he did was a little worse because it affected individual people. So you know, you've got the imagine if it was the best actress category and the wrong person had come up and given the speech and then had to retract. So at least this was best picture, where it was a little bit more, you know, in a group setting and not
you're safe in a group, you're safe in numbers.
Not one category. I felt really bad for them. But they accepted the defeat, I use air quotes here, with some grace.
And also I think, you know, given previous Oscars, you're more fascinated with the winners and, you know, the outfits they wear. But for the first time, as far as I can remember, you know, now PwC gets a shout out here for the wrong reasons.
Accountancy firm PwC PricewaterhouseCoopers, they were responsible for the winners' cards that were handed out at the ceremony and for counting the ballots. And now they've come out to apologize for the mistake, and they're investigating the mix-up. So what happened was a PwC partner had essentially tweeted, he was on Twitter, on social media, just moments before the mix-up happened. So that begs the question, was he distracted by Twitter or by tweeting and gave Warren Beatty the wrong envelope?
The pitfalls of using social media while on the job. I mean, come on.
Don't multitask.
It's 101 right here, man. Come on.
Oh, dear. Okay, so there you go. Brian Cullinan, the PwC partner, getting worldwide attention right now. We'll be back with more news and discussion after this in just a few minutes. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Positively 4th Street by Bob Dylan there. Hello and good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run with me, Melissa Idris, and Tan Chung Han this morning. Now, there's a new site that has gotten quite a lot of popularity across the Arab world. It allows users to send and receive anonymous messages from people in their social networks. Essentially, it's called Saraha, which is the Arabic word for honesty, and it allows users to do this. For instance, I'll give you an example. I think there's been lots of declarations of love on this site. I love you, but I'm married. And then there's a couple of remarks on people's personalities, declarations of their sexual identity as well on this site.
Now, looking at the BBC article on this particular site, it says, you know, it's carrying a quote here that says, "Get constructive criticism from friends and colleagues in total anonymity." And I'm thinking that's a bit idealistic because, you know, when it comes to just, you know, the very popular use of social media, you know, and when you look at comments, right, on posts, on YouTube videos and the like, they tend to be, you know, negative in nature, right? I mean, there's a word for it, and it's called trolls. And that seems to be the more evident use or the nature of the feedback that you get on social media, right? So I guess, yes, there is the possibility of having anonymous expressions of love and affection and constructive criticism, sure.
Right.
But would you want to keep your constructive criticism, you know,
anonymous? Yeah. Exactly. Like, how constructive can it be if it's anonymous? Yeah. I completely agree with you. I think there are some of the criticisms when it comes to this site is, why do you have to hide behind anonymity to be honest with each other? And I think it boils down to, I don't know whether it's cultural. So the developer of the site was, he had the business market in mind. He wasn't planning for declarations of love or comments on somebody's personality. What he had wanted to do was provide a platform for companies to be able to give feedback to each other, because he noticed that employees had trouble giving feedback to bosses. So he said, okay, well, let's have an anonymous site, which I think is equally as dangerous. You know, yeah. I mean, if you have an anonymous review of your boss, I mean, you're just going to put it out there.
That could trigger a witch hunt right there. I was like, all right, company meeting right now. Everyone in the conference room.
No, but it's. I think it just it doesn't help foster good communication. If you have to do it anonymously, if you have to do it on a website, and you're not even able to sit down with someone and say, hey, you know, you have a really difficult management style. Could you in the future avoid saying this or doing this? I mean, that is a lot healthier and more constructive in the long run, as opposed to posting something online and saying, well, you know, you are a terrible manager. You're not a good leader. You don't follow what you say, and you make us do all this work.
And all the expletives will follow, right?
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
But then, no, I'm thinking, okay, I'm no expert on the, you know, the overall culture in the Arab world, you know, but I can see how perhaps this may work for, say, Western cultures. Again, the stereotype of Western cultures. But when it comes to Asian cultures, though, we tend to be non-confrontational. At least that's the picture that's being painted. You know, we tend to avoid these kind of serious discussions. We tend to be agreeable when if face to face, but then perhaps you know we'll then discuss you know the real issues in a separate, you know, quiet place.
In a separate WhatsApp group.
Right. Exactly. You know, it's and like you know, having been in the media industry for a while now, there's always the press conference, and then reporters will have the press conference after the press conference. Well, they will kapong the
ambush. Ambush. Yeah. Or they call it jolo, where you just stick your microphone in the face.
That's right.
You know,
basically doorstop the person. You know, it's the PC and after the PC. You know, so when it comes to Asian cultures and the stereotypes of it, I don't know if this kind of service or this kind of website would really gain some traction.
Okay, that's interesting. It could be a cultural. Yeah. It could be a cultural thing. So, Han, do you remember back in the early 2000s there was a site called, and I'm can't really remember what it's called. Something about my dirty little secret or my secret, my innermost secret. And it was photos of people confessing their innermost secrets. And some of them were really touching and heartbreaking and really reflective of the struggles that people go through that you know nothing about. You know, the lives people live until I think this was an avenue to express themselves. And I'm wondering whether a site like this could be cathartic in some way for people who don't have an outlet to be able to say, okay, this is my deepest secret. I can't tell anyone, but I'm going to post it anonymously on social media.
But knowing that you do have an audience out there, you know, like people who
care.
Yeah, you know. But then I guess bringing it back to its original intentions, I wonder if this site can be a way for colleagues to express their love for each other. You know.
Well, let's not go there. But speaking about connecting on social media with your colleagues, when is it okay to become friends with, say, your boss on social media? So let's just say, you know, you see your boss on social media. Is it or you'll get a friend request from your boss on Facebook? When is it okay to click yes or to befriend your boss? Is that a really bad idea, or do you see that as, you know, a really good opportunity to connect with him on an individual level, him or her, excuse me, on an individual level rather than just, you know, the robot that you are at the desk?
Well, I think you have painted two very distinctive scenarios right there. And I think, generally speaking, it's a bad idea to have your boss on Facebook. No offense to my bosses at BFM. If you're listening right now, hey, I love you very much. One of you during working hours.
I don't think any of us are. I'm not sure, actually, because I'm not on Facebook, to be completely honest with you. Just keep it safe.
Yeah. No, I mean, here's the thing. Because, like, say you've got... if your boss sends you that friend request, he or she will know if you don't, you know, accept that friend request.
Oh, will they? Will they
know?
Yeah,
they will.
If you reject it?
Right. So, like, you know, I think the initiative has to lie with the boss. Don't send those requests to your employees, please. You know, it's like, you can just scan their public profile. Sure.
But if your boss wants to get to know you better, you know, to find out what your hobbies
are. Come to my desk.
What does Han do in his free time? Where was Han's last vacation?
Come to my desk. Talk to me. Or, heck, you know, I'll use that, you know, anonymous website thingy that I'll to give you a review then.
According to some surveys, 57% of managers say they find a request from an employee weird. So just bear that in mind next time you want to think about befriending your boss on Facebook.
Yeah, and bosses, do us a favor, don't send us that request.
Okay.
I love you though.
It's time for the 6:30 News Bulletin with Keith Kum on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. Give me hope, Joanna. could thereby Eddie Grant. Excuse me. I'm Melissa Idris with Tan Cheng Han this morning. A little off my off my toes today, but stay with us. Stay with us. 6:40 this morning. We're taking a look at women on women representation on boards. Now, according to some news articles in the UK, it looks like the number of women being promoted to the boards of UK's largest companies have slowed for the first time starting this month. And there's been a lot of debate as to why this is happening in the UK. What do you think are some of the reasons why, Han?
Well, I think essentially, you know, it boils down to the age-old debate, you know, over career versus family life, right? You know, having to find a balance between, you know, your commitments in the workplace and also your ambitions, your career ambitions, you know, versus your commitments to the family and what society expects of you, you know, as a woman. I mean, I would again assume.
Well, okay, so there was an article in the Evening Standard that cited Sarah Edmondson, who is the first? Who will be the first female boss of a listed UK-based oil firm? And she said, controversially, that women are partly to blame for the lack of females on company boards. Now, she's returning to as chief executive of Safran Energy after her maternity leave in June, and she said that women are penalising themselves by not applying for higher roles, on concern that they will have difficulties balancing their work and personal life. It's a valid concern, though. You may not apply for the role of CEO because you're thinking, well, I've got a baby at home. You know, I can't spend 15 hours a day at work. I've got little kids and a family to raise, which is a valid concern. But those are some of the reasons why we're seeing a lack of representation of women on boards.
Yeah, but then for Sarah Edmondson, she's saying that, you know, women are partly to be blamed. You know, again, they are penalizing themselves, though. But I wonder if that is a really a fair representation, you know, of the dilemma that many women face, right? Because at the end of the day, you know, you do want to do as good a job as you can, but, you know, let's face it, given the different roles that society expects women to, you know, perform, be it as a mother, a daughter, you know, a worker,
right,
a wife. You know, so how do you juggle all those things? You know, it almost seems like something has to give, right?
Right.
So, you know, very often we have seen too many women then give up their career ambitions. Like my mom, for example, you know, she was working, and then when the fourth kid came along, I'm one of 9 kids, by the way.
That's a big family, my friend.
So when the fourth kid came along, she's like, all right, no, I'm going to stop, you know, and just focus on the family, right? So that comes, there's an opportunity cost, I would think. So I wonder if that's rather harsh to say that women are penalizing themselves. I don't know, what do you think?
Okay, I think that in a business respect, in a business sense, yes, I think there are lots of women who are capable of holding positions a lot higher than the ones that they're currently holding. And it's a give and take. It's a trade-off, right? So they make that decision. They opt not to go for a higher position simply because they know they cannot commit to all aspects of their lives. I don't know whether that's penalizing, because I think it is a choice that women make. What I do think is the unfortunate factor here is that women feel unsupported in this respect, that they have to make that trade-off.
Right.
So if they had, you know, they had more support for family, more support for flexible work, more support for, you know, support from not just the community, but also the business and the family, then perhaps there might not need to be a trade-off.
Yeah, and we'll explore that support aspect in just a bit. But then I think also at the same time, I think a very key point has to be made here, whereby, you know, many women, my mom included, find great fulfillment in, you know, just being dedicated moms and wives, and, you know, like attending to their family's needs. You know, so you know, having those career ambitions, of course, you know, it's great and it needs to be supported. You know, and we see that here at the various initiatives by the Malaysian government as well. But then I think, you know, it would not be fair to then, you know, give this impression that, oh, career ambitions, you know, would perhaps, you know, take precedence over, say, your family commitments. No,
right.
I think there are many women who have chosen for themselves.
It's a choice, right?
Yeah,
it's a choice.
choice. They want to dedicate themselves to the family.
What do you think about this quota of, you know, having 30% women representation on boards? I remember speaking to the 30% club, and they are not in favor of a quota because, you know, they say it's about merit, right? But the way they view is that you have to get the ecosystem to change. So as we spoke about the support, we also the biggest mandate, I think, for the biggest push that 30% club wants to do is to change the mindsets of men, because you can't have, you know, you can't have full change unless you get the men involved. Yeah. So I think that's really important.
And then at the same time, when you see these structural deficiencies, you know, and say a patriarchal society, you know, that is often synonymous with the Asian culture, for example, how do you then overcome those inequalities without these kind of policies? I mean, it's easy to say, let's change the mindset or the culture, you know, of men in particular. But then if it's not backed up with any kind of policies or mandate, then, you know, how is it going to...
Wait a minute. So you think that there needs to be a policy or a quota put in place so that this is achievable?
Yeah, no, because, I mean, look, meritocracy, it's a great ideal, but let's face it, in the realities, you know, of your everyday world, there are many shortcomings, right? You know, how do you... And look, how you judge merits is very different from someone else. You know, so if, let's say, the status quo, right, the existing nature of things is more, it's dominated by males, okay,
right,
then how do you overcome that imbalance, right? There has to be a will from somewhere else. So it appears that perhaps these policies can kind of give you that will.
Because
I would love it for, you know, men to be able to say, you know, yes, you know, we can recognize, not to say I'm speaking on behalf of all men.
You are the voice of mankind.
Yeah, right now, oh man, tough gig right now. But it would be nice to say that this can naturally evolve to where gender inequality will resolve itself. You know, I would love to see that happen. But look, let's face it, that is idealistic, right?
Well, okay, I am against quotas of any kind. I don't think that's the way, you know, a free market should work. It should be merit-based. How would you then, stop abuses of that quota, for instance? If you had a policy in place, how would you stop a token woman representation on boards? You know, you've got companies then saying, okay, I'm just going to elect my wife or my sister or someone just to fill up the numbers.
Right, yeah.
Because that's not true to the spirit of what this is. This is trying to get women up the leadership ladder and make sure that women can affect change for other women by being on the top of the company.
But if, let's say, there weren't these kind of policies, right, then wouldn't the status quo remain? Like, how do you then... I mean, it's... I would imagine it'd be monumentally harder to try and change the mindset and culture rather than have policies in place.
That's true. I think at the moment, there are some countries in the world that have already allocated this quota, this 30% women. I think some of the countries in Europe as well has done this. It'll be interesting to see if it has borne the results that they had initially wanted. You know, by having a quota of 30%, has that down the road shown, be reflective of having more women leaders in the succession line, having an improved workplace policy for women and families?
No, certainly. And also, Malaysia has a lot of catching up to do. For example, recent media reports say that the women's participation at the decision-making level in corporate Malaysia is at about 10%, where else, according to media reports, over in the UK, they were 29% of hires to UK boards as of 2016,
right,
although that's down from the 32% that they saw in 2014.
Mm.
But still, we've got a 20 percentage point gap there that we have to basically narrow, hence that policy for a 30% club. Now, that's not to say that the Malaysian government hasn't been rolling out initiatives to support women at the grassroots level as well. Now, our previous conversation was women at the board level,
right,
the decision-making level. But you've got, R20 million for microcredit loans for Malaysian Chinese women entrepreneurs, R300 million for Tekun, that includes dudes, women micro entrepreneurs, you know, etc. There's even support for women who are still breastfeeding. There's a 1,000 ringgit tax relief for breastfeeding equipment, you know. So there are initiatives being rolled out, not just at the top level, 30% club, but also for, you know, your average working woman.
I have to say, though, that whenever we have this discussion, I always go back to this conversation, a video that I heard from the PepsiCo CEO, Indra Nooyi. She famously and controversially said that women cannot have it all. And she, when she said that, it was like, oh my God, what?
Yeah.
But, you know, her candor and her ability to say, well, she struggled in her initial parts of her career because, you know, at that time her kids were very small. She's taking care of an ailing mother. She's trying to give attention to her marriage. And at that point in time, she felt like she couldn't do it all. And I think that was one of the articles or the videos that really spoke to me, because it was finally a woman in power who came out to say, well, it's hard, guys. It's really hard. And what you need to be able to succeed is support. Support. You have to co-opt all your friends and your family and your relatives and your staff and your bosses to be able to do this. So really, no one gets there alone. Okay, it's 10 minutes to the top of the hour, and we've got the 7 o'clock news headlines, so stay tuned for that. After that, Market Watch with Joe Quinlan from the UK. So stay tuned, from the US, excuse me, from New York. Stay tuned for that on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.